Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is
Sonia, we are concluding Season 2 of X-Men Evolution. We're on Episode 17, an episode called Day of Reckoning Part 2. Quite an exciting and unexpected episode, I thought.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, a lot to talk about there. Wow, awesome for an X-Men Evolution episode.
Yeah.
All right, we'll get to that. We have a lot of other interesting stuff to get to as well before we start talking about that episode. But let's get the plugs out of the way. You can follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Join the X-Men Task Podcast Facebook group on Facebook. Rate and review the show 5 stars on iTunes, whatever podcast service you use. We always appreciate the support there. And give us a follow on Twitch at twitch.tv/Willie8911 for potential future live broadcasts of the show. Now, there's a couple of major things we have to talk about before we get into the Season 2 finale of X-Men Evolution. Normally we talk about WandaVision first, but I'm going to put that on the back burner because I just spent the last 48 hours reading the new book by author Abraham Reisman, Stan Lee, True Believer. Let me get the full title correct here. True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee by Abraham Reisman. I got this book. I saw some good reviews of it. I was like, oh, interesting, like the first major biography of Stan Lee since he's passed away. The book in the Amazon description promised that it would talk about every single thing, including all the things that happened late in his life. I was intrigued because I thought a lot of the sad news that happened late in his life before he died was really sketchy and weird. I was like, oh, that'll be interesting to get the full takes on that. And I'm also just like a huge, as everyone who listens to this podcast know, a huge fan of classic Marvel comics from the 1960s in general, the Stan Lee era, the Jack Kirby era, Steve Ditko down the line. So I got this book. I could not put it down once I started reading it. You saw me reading it.
Yeah, all day, all night.
All day, all night, until I was finished. I have a lot of thoughts on this book. The first thing I'm going to say is get the book. I think it's an essential Marvel historical book along the lines of Sean Howe's Untold History of Marvel Comics. Obviously, this is more about Stan Lee than that one was, which tried to tell a broader history, but it has some overlapping information. It goes into, obviously, a lot greater detail on the life of Stan Lee himself. I don't even know where to begin here. This book was an emotional roller coaster for me. I'm deep into Marvel historical lore, so I knew a lot of the stories. I did not know them to the level of details, especially the stuff that happened later in Stan Lee's life with his failed business enterprises in the late 90s and early 2000s with, I guess, his website, stanlee.net, and his later POW Entertainment, which turned out, basically from the book, to be like massive criminal scams on Trumpian levels. I can't really even think of a more apt comparison. Like complete Wall Street frauding, investor defrauding, tech bubble type lunacy that Stan Lee was at the heart of. So all of that stuff was totally elucidating. I really knew not much about that, but it's hard to even know where to begin with this book without just recapping the whole thing, so I'm just going to give some highlights.
Okay.
You get an incredible history of Stan Lee's family's origins, starting in Romania, in Jewish cities in Romania at the turn of the 20th century, and from the 19th to the 20th century, how his family, along with thousands of other Romanian Jews, immigrated to the United States because there was, like, one of the frequent rises of anti-Semitic outbreaks in Europe that would obviously plague that continent throughout the century. There was, like, a huge one, like, right around the year 1900 or 20 years prior, even before the family emigrated. You learn a lot about his childhood growing up in New York City in the Upper West Side. His parents, which are interesting, they are pretty, they're pretty sort of, I was interested in how the author described how the parents are very invested in their Jewish heritage. Not to like an overly religious sense, but just in a pride of their heritage sense. And how that had very little impact on Stan Lee. He was essentially an out-and-out atheist at a young age, and that's interesting, you know. My family is very similar to Stan Lee's. A lot of it immigrated from Eastern Europe by around the turn of the century. Jewish families, also like, went from being Jewish to essentially being atheists early on. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's the story of a lot of Jewish immigrants that came to New York City around that time. You know, a lot of them kept their culture and heritage, but the religious aspect of it, like, faded away for a lot of immigrants. And a lot of Jewish immigrants of that era, like, embraced being American, like, creating a new American identity for their children and their children's children,
yeah.
That whole thing. So Stanley's in that line, which is very interesting. And, you know, you get a sense of his childhood and growing up in New York and his professional career, which we've talked about previously in the podcast. He started off so young at Marvel, which was then known as Timely Comics. He essentially got the job through his, you know, Martin Goodman, who was the owner of Timely Comics, and then later became Marvel. He had other publishing. Marvel was just a small branch initially of his publishing empire. Martin Goodman was like Stanley's uncle or step cousin, something. He was not like exactly direct relation, but you know, he got the job. Stanley got the job through family connection. It's not something Stanley was ever happy about. It seemed like he had a lot of resentment through his life that he was connected to Martin Goodman on a familial level in any way. In fact, he would embellish stories about how he just answered an ad in the newspaper, and that's how he got the job.
He was, like, embarrassed to admit that it was, like, nepotism.
It's difficult to say. The author says that there might have been a chance that it just so happened that his uncle, whatever, worked at this place where he answered an ad, but probably not, because the book establishes a clear, long history of Stan Lee embellishing the truth to outright lying throughout his entire life.
Mm.
And that's going to trigger the emotional roller coaster. I mean, everyone knows that Stan Lee was a showman. He was a huckster.
Mm-hmm.
He was a larger-than-life ad man, in a sense. He was a promoter. But the level of which he was, like, a self-deluding liar or outright craven liar, the author really, like, lays it on thick, and mm-hmm. I think convincingly so. I mean, the thing is, you know, coming with myself pre-baked with a lot of this knowledge, this author just, like, cements a lot of evidence to conclude that, like, the worst aspects of Stan Lee. We've recounted the story before, but I'll jump ahead into history to the time everyone's interested in, the 1960s, where Jack Kirby is hired with Marvel. It's just about, like, failing as a company. Martin Goodman's going to maybe close down the comic books wing of his publishing company, and Stan Lee by that point is, like, you know, the main employee there.
Mm.
And Jack Kirby comes along, and, you know, as the sort of fake story goes, with Stan Lee they co-created the Marvel Universe, and all these hits sprung forth, and Steve Ditko is Spider-Man, the biggest hit of them all. You know, we've had this debate many times about what was Stan Lee responsible for, what was Jack Kirby responsible for, what was Steve Ditko responsible for. The impression I got after reading this book is that, like, at best, from a creative side, Stan Lee was responsible for maybe 10% of all the characters we know and love.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I just got the sense that Jack Kirby outright invented nearly everything, drew it all, plotted it all. It wasn't really mentioned in this book, but I've seen other primary sources where essentially Jack Kirby would write the dialogue underneath the panels of each of his, you know, original pages, artwork he would submit to Marvel. And Stan Lee would either just write what he wrote, or more than likely he did jazz it up in it. I mean, that's undeniable that Stan Lee did write the dialogue. The question is, like, how much of the dialogue did he really write? But either way, I mean, he put his personal...
So it's not that Steve Ditko was writing dialogue. He was writing, like, a description of what was supposed to be happening?
It's tough to say.
Oh.
It's tough to say if they were writing, like, outright dialogue and Stan Lee just edited it and made it more interesting. Because Stan Lee has a distinct dialogue writing style,
mm-hmm.
and it is great. I mean, if you love 60s Marvel Comics as I do, you do love the writing style that Stan Lee puts in there. But, I mean, Stan Lee in the book describes it as, like, it was like doing a crossword puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's got, like, the entire plot laid out in front of him, all the pictures drawn, and, like, essentially a breakdown of every scene.
Mm-hmm.
So him just writing the dialogue while...
someone else is coming up with storylines and all the plot points.
Right. I mean, he's not, like, dreaming up the scenarios.
Right.
And he's not necessarily even inventing the characters of Doctor Doom. I mean, what does Doctor Doom look like? What are his powers? What's his backstory? He's not... I mean, he might have come up with it. So I love that the book said that when it comes to the creation of the great Marvel characters, you only have two primary accounts. You have Stan Lee's version of events, and you have Jack Kirby's version of events. And mm-hmm. they're both polar opposites from each other.
Mm.
There's no, like, real...
There's no proof.
There's no solid evidence one way or the other, but the circumstantial evidence points towards Jack Kirby probably being way more truthful and accurate when he just said, I invented everything, mm. and Stan Lee had very little to do with it. Mm. It's a tricky... Again, it's like the ultimate mystery of Marvel Comics, of like who's responsible for what. Mm-hmm. And both of them were victimized in a way by their corporate overlords for different reasons.
I mean,
because Stan Lee didn't like get ownership of all these characters he supposedly even if you're giving him full creation credit.
I mean, I understand, but at the same time, that's kind of just that's the nature of business, right? Like, I'm not a comic book creator, but right. like my job is to write content for a company that I work for. And I understand that when I like signed up to work with this company, I'm not going to receive compensation for years to come, like passive income on things that I've written right. or out there in the world that people are using.
But what
it's
if
like
what
the company hires you and they're paying you for your time and ideas?
And that's why Jack Kirby and a lot of the other artists didn't complain too much for the most of the 60s, and why they kept working with Stan, even though he would write his name written by Stan Lee.
Right.
Because who cared about who created what back
right.
then?
It's a Marvel comic.
It was a totally disposable children's product that nobody knew the greater cultural after effects of this run of comics from the 1960s and what they would mean from a financial standpoint to these mega corporations down the line
right.
and from a sort of creative clout standpoint of who's the genius. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter back then. So you get the impression in the book that Stan Lee's out there at college lecture circuits, as Marvel is increasing in popularity, taking credit for all this. Like, still, who gives a shit? It's not making Stan Lee that much more money than Jack Kirby, in mm-hmm. a sense. I mean, Stan Lee had like a higher job title. He was making a better salary than Jack Kirby. But Jack Kirby was a work for a higher artist, and so he was annoyed that he was doing all this work and Stan Lee was taking credit. But ultimately, still back then, the world of comics was taken so unseriously that it's like it wasn't that level of fighting wasn't worth it to Jack Kirby, even though he despised Stan Lee, as you read in the book, like for many interesting reasons, which I won't really spoil. You got to get the book. But the thing is, it's like Stan Lee got away with it for decades because for so long, from 1961 when Fantastic Four came out through like when the mid to late 90s before Blade comes out in the first X-Men movie, Marvel was like, while beloved by so many people around the world, from like a major cultural standpoint, it was just like a nerdy curiosity thing. You know, it's like everyone loves Spider-Man, but what was Spider-Man but a comic book cartoon character essentially in all those years?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've tracked with the X-Men animated series the rise of, like, of multimedia Marvel power throughout this podcast and that show's history, how it led to the movies, how there's, like, wait a second, like, you know, Margaret Loesch was the producer that brought it to Fox Kids with, you know, Eric and Julia Leewald and Larry Houston, the, you know, producer, director, animator of the show, they began the magical project of translating the comic books into a animated real life form, and then that led itself into the movies, as we've discussed a million times. So then it blows up into this massive thing, and then all of a sudden, it's a $4 billion company being sold to Disney, and every movie is making $1 billion plus, more or less. And it's this massive worldwide sensation. It's some of the most valuable intellectual property in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Jack Kirby died in 1994 and Stan Lee was on his last legs by like 2017, 2018, it's like all of a sudden the question of who did what became way more serious.
Yeah.
And all the like bullshit of Stan Lee's life and all these feuds he got and these petty business screwing overs he did of Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and the like and many other artists, including his brother, Larry Lieber, which is a tragic part of this book, how he fucked him over constantly. I mean, even though he did sort of like help him be employed at Marvel, still he did not do a good job with his brother. All that stuff becomes like of vital more importance, and with a lot of long-lasting legacy questions for Stan himself and like the meaning of this thing that is just now so universally beloved. So the book like dives into all that, and you have to just you read the book and you just have to like sit there and reckon with like this history. And I felt kind of bad. I mean, because I mean, I still in my heart I still do love Stan Lee. And the thing the book does make clear, too, is that he was a great comic books editor. That's undeniable. He was a very good, snappy dialogue writer for these characters. And he did more than anyone else to promote Marvel Comics, that he kept a little company that could have folded any time over, Stanley promoted to an extent where it never would die, mm-hmm. and it kept going. So that, in from that standpoint alone, he deserves an enormous amount of credit.
Just not necessarily the credit that he took the credit for other things.
Right, the credit that like makes him a genius. Uh-huh. That he like saw a like the bullshit stories he would tell was like, I saw a spider climbing in my office, and I thought that'd be a great idea for a hero. Uh-huh. Spider-Man. Like, he didn't... I mean, Steve Ditko came up with that shit.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, and there's just stuff where he... like, he takes credit for inventing Doctor Strange, which is... they found an interview with him in the 1960s saying, like, Steve Ditko introduced Doctor Strange in one of our new, like, Strange Fantasy Tales books. I think it's, like, a, you know, a weak premise, but we'll see how it goes. Uh-huh. But then later on, Stanley's like, Doctor Strange came from my, like, love of black magic and all. It's like, he did nothing... he didn't care.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, there's just other... the last few tidbits I'll talk about just that sort of surprised me. One, he hated comic books. He thought his entire life he was trying to escape the industry. He thought they were beneath him. He would lie to people at all his fancy social gatherings about the like about his job. Yeah, because he was so embarrassed. I mean, up to the point when he started to get famous for it, that changed, mm-hmm. obviously. But even still, he always had this dream to be recognized for a greater genius, for writing a book or a screenplay, being a famous actor he was obsessed with.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, his biggest dream was to be rich and famous. That comes across in the book, just in a very basic sense.
Okay.
To be loved. Well,
he became famous.
Yes, and it came later in life, but he didn't quite... is tinged with bitterness because...
it's not what he wanted to be famous for.
Not what he wanted to be famous for.
He wanted to be involved in more, like, high culture, not, like, lowbrow comic...
right. He thought... he could never get away in his own mind that comics were just, like, a shit medium for kids, and this was just a crappy job that he got forced into because he's a Depression-era kid that took a job from his uncle.
Right.
And so he didn't really love comic books. What else was I going to say about this? The other thing that I thought was shocking is he supposedly hated the superhero movies, of which he loved doing those cameos for.
Yeah.
He loved doing the cameos because he loved the attention. He would not stay. He would go to the red carpet premieres and talk up the movies. He would leave immediately. Wouldn't see the movie. So they said in the book, they said he only saw maybe two or three of the movies from beginning to end in his whole life. And he would tell people at parties that he hated all superhero movies. Wow. So I was just like... wow, like the level of like deceit. I mean, it's like, it's not that much of a deceit because it's silly to like who cares if you really like superhero movies, but the fact that he's on, whenever you see him on TV the past 20 years just talking them up like they're so wonderful,
yeah,
that he just privately thought, this is fucking shit and I don't like it. I just found that like more funny than anything.
Yeah.
But also illuminating. I mean, the book is bonkers. I mean, the stuff about his family is really screwed up and sad. His wife, who's like, he had a very long, loving marriage with his wife, but him and his wife, maybe not the best parents. Mm. They raised a real hellion of a child, their only child they had, their daughter.
Yeah.
There's just like psychotic stuff written about her in the book, like unbelievable, outrageous behavior.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'll tell the most shocking story real quick, and then we'll move on, I promise. Like, they spoiled her rotten her entire life. She never had to work, she never had to do anything. So, and you know, Stan and his wife lived a long time. So at their daughter's 64th birthday, they lease her a Jaguar, a car, and she's so enraged that they didn't outright buy it for her that that's when the creepy stuff you read about elderly abuse comes in, where she supposedly smashed her mother into a window and knocked Stanley's head against his wooden chair. And the police might have been called. I'm not quite sure. It's a little fuzzy because they dismissed the charges. Like, they would never wanted to really punish their daughter. They just indulged her way too much. Mm-hmm. But she was just, like, out of control. I'm just, like, thinking in my head, like, imagine being 64 years old and getting this, like, insane gift but still acting like a spoiled brat of, yeah, like, a 12-year-old you'd see in a movie.
That's sad.
Yeah, I mean, just, like, that whole dynamic was really icky and depressing to get a sense of. All right, I won't talk more about it, but, again... Abraham Reisman, amazing job, true believer. The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, just an incredible page-turning book. I don't think, if you love Marvel Comics, I don't think you'll be disappointed in reading it. It's just very interesting. And I'm just sort of like bowled over by that book.
Left a big impression.
Yes, it certainly did. So I thoroughly recommend everyone getting it. Okay, now let's get on to topic number two before we get into the episode, WandaVision.
Okay.
I don't have much to say about this week's. I thought it was okay. I thought it was a bit of a step back for me.
Mm.
In turn, I have a feeling the last two episodes are going to be really good.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, again, like a little bit of a like kicking the can down the road episode. What do you think about it?
I didn't think it was as bad as you seem to think it was.
Well, it wasn't bad. I just thought it was like not remarkable.
Right. I mean, spoilers as always, so skip ahead a little if you haven't watched it yet. But I thought like they did some interesting character development with Monica.
Rambo.
Yeah, we got to see her.
Do you like the slight different pronunciation? She's Monica Rambo as opposed to John Rambo. I know they're totally different characters. It sticks out to me every time.
Really?
Yeah.
It's funny.
Is John Rambo's a French name?
I don't know, but when you pronounce them differently like that, when you say Rambo, you know, like Stallone, it makes me picture an O at the end.
Right.
When you say Rambo, I picture like E-A-U-X.
Right, yeah, same.
Yeah.
But I still, it's to me, in my brain, it's the same name. But whatever, diversion.
Okay. Anyway, I thought, you know, I like getting some more character development with her. We know she's going to be a superhero. Like, we see it come to life. It's
Captain
cool.
Photon or something.
Yeah.
I don't know much about the character.
I liked the bit of development with Darcy and Vision, where, like, she makes it in, and then he's able to actually, like, snap her back to her own personality so that she can actually, like, mobilize and do stuff. And,
okay.
Like, he's figuring out what's going on. Sort of.
I didn't like the Modern Family premise or the Office confessional sitcom premise.
Yeah.
I thought by this point it felt a bit too formulaic of we're going from I Love Lucy to Bewitched to Partridge Family or something to 80s sitcoms to you know what I mean? Like it just, it's like why in Wanda's brain is it happening this way? Like that it just feels just like this is just the TV show's idea of a fun gimmick to progress.
Yeah, totally. Why is this the week that, like, the straw that broke the camel's back?
Because I just don't, it just, to me, it made, in my head canon, like, they might explain all this later in the next, it was just like Wanda was probably nostalgic for television she grew up with in a kid and wants to live there. But if you're going to keep progressing it into the modern day, that idea that I had, which is I'm not saying is based in anything, like that goes out the window. Then I'm just thinking, like, what is this? It's just an idea of let's just do different TV formats through the ages.
Yeah.
Versus, like, maybe this is all had meaning for Wanda, that she grew up in Sokovia watching I Love Lucy and you know, all those, like, I Dream of Jeannie and all these classic shows, and that, like, brought her great comfort. Versus, like, now she's in the 2000s watching Modern Family. I'm not, the premise can still hold up, but it just felt like a little more thin to me.
Yeah, I could see that. It's not really connected to anything, maybe.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. So, so, I mean, that was, like, my biggest problem with the episode more than anything, that I just thought that the overall premise was starting to feel a bit thin.
My biggest problem with the episode was the very last, not the post-credits sequence, but, like, right before they rolled the credits, that song and dance they did about, like, it was with Agatha Catherine the Hahn. Whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever their tagline is. Like, that's one of those cases where I wish they would, like, show, not tell. Like, let us see that it's been her the whole time, and we figure it out, and we're like, oh my god, it's been her the whole time. When you, like, sing a song about it, I'm, like, a little turned off.
I agree. I also think that it was also a plot twist that was so easily figured out by everyone on the internet.
Yeah.
If you're going to make her Agatha Harkness, which is a witch character from the Marvel Universe,
right,
don't name her Agnes and make it so much more obvious. Like, yeah, they centralized, like, her. Name her Betty or something. At least, like, throw it off a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, because it...
Were they worried that people weren't going to get it because it's too much of, like, a deep dive
but,
that people
I mean,
don't know about?
It's an obscure,
like,
character in the first place. So, yeah. The fact that they just named it Agnes was just red meat to, like, super nerds on the internet that spread the message, like, as Agatha Harkness has to be.
Yeah.
So I thought that was just, like, when they do the song and dance about it, it's like, okay, well, we kind of already saw it coming. She was clearly, there's something messed up about her.
Yeah.
I do love Catherine Hahn, though. So.
Yeah, I do too. I think she's a great actress.
Right. I don't think it takes away from her performance in the show. She's still amazing.
No, I just thought that was, like, kind of stupid, like, screenwriting.
It also didn't really advance the plot in a specific way. It was just kind of like saying, like, she's a trickster and she's been manipulating Wanda somehow.
I thought it was just meant to, like, set up the last episodes that are coming out. Just saying, like, okay, now you have an explanation for why everything has looked this way. Now you have an explanation for why Wanda has seemed so confused about
So you think
that
is
her.
The explanation why she's in the TV land? Because Agatha, it's not a Wanda desire?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, I think they're going to explain it in a pretty satisfying way. I'm not worried about that. But I'm with you on the sort of like the hokiness.
It just felt heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Unnecessary.
My last desire for this show is that I want Quicksilver to mean something. Mm. I don't want him to be a conjured demon. I want him to be, you know, Pietro Maximoff.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever version you're going to say. Like, maybe he's just the Aaron Taylor Johnson version, just, you know, redone as Evan Peters for whatever reason. That's fine with me, too. I don't care if he's from the Fox universe specifically, but I want him to be Quicksilver.
Mm.
I want that character to be real. I don't want it to be a fake character. I want to just say, like, oh, it was just a dream or something.
Mm.
I want Marvel to take a big swing here and, like...
But then they're going to have to, like, backtrack a little bit, because in this episode, the twins are asking something about, like, where did he go or something, and... Or he said right. such and such thing, and Wanda's like, oh, don't trust him. He's not your uncle. So it's like they're already kind of setting up
But we don't know, and she doesn't know really
yeah,
who he is.
I guess, yeah.
And at the end of the post-credits scene, you got the sense that maybe Quicksilver's there to help Monica Rambeau. Maybe not. But it could be the thing that's like, hey, I've been trapped here too. We got to get out of here.
Hmm.
I've read that speculation online. I mean, it's just random speculation. It's not like indicative of anything. But people are saying that Quicksilver was brought over from the alternate Fox universe and he wants to escape.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Maybe we get a scene where Vision touches Quicksilver's head and he gets jolted back into reality. That would be great. That'd be really exciting.
Yeah.
So... Show obviously still captivating in the sense that you can't wait to see what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like, not my favorite episode of the bunch just yet.
Okay.
Peaked more in the middle.
Yeah.
And then I think it's gonna accelerate in the conclusion.
Yeah.
A lot of people are speculating too, last thing we'll see about is the bunny.
Uh-huh.
Like, who's the bunny?
Yeah.
The bunny is like people are saying, oh, maybe it's Doctor Strange captured.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Or some other like amazing magical or super fantastic character.
That could be.
I don't know. We'll see. So WandaVision continues to entertain, despite it being a bit uneven at times, at least in my assessment. Did you mostly enjoy that episode, or
yeah,
like more
I
than
did.
I did? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay. I think so. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I think like it's kind of the nature of this storytelling format where you have your 8 episodes. There have to be like peaks and valleys. You know,
yeah.
You have to have like that conflict resolution roller coaster to keep your interest the whole time. So, not every single episode can ride like
yeah.
that predictable wave, because then that becomes like too repetitive and you lose interest anyways. So
yeah, I agree. It's just what so much of TV now is just so connective and serialized.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, we brought up the example many times. It's not like Star Trek where you just have one-offs
yeah.
and some one-offs are better than others. Like
yeah.
a spellbinding 42-minute episode where they just go on a singular adventure. There's a beginning, middle, and end.
Uh-huh.
It's like now most shows are like WandaVision.
Okay,
it's like a ramping up. It's
Star
like a
Trek.
Ramping, yeah.
It's like some of those episodes are 42 minutes of like nothing. Like some
mm-hmm.
of those episodes are just bad. Like they're
yeah.
dull or
yep.
they're awkward or they're hard to watch for some reason.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, if you're really a fan, like you still stick it out and watch those at least once through
mm-hmm.
because all together you get like this tapestry of this universe
yeah.
that like you're glad to have the information of like those dull or awkward episodes just to be like, okay, that exists in this
yeah.
universe too.
There's also the difference between then and now is so much of serialized television is 10 to 13 episodes today, whereas Star Trek it was 22 to 24 to 26 episodes per season.
Yeah.
So the sheer level of extra time they had to tell a story in a singular season where you just like had to do divergent random dumbass stories
yeah.
because you can't like construct this, like you to borrow the word you just use, tapestry of like a continuous singular tale.
Well,
you can.
That's how you get soap operas.
That's true.
That's like a whole different flavor.
Touché. But yeah, right. But I mean, in the sci-fi, whatever action adventure format of TV, it's interesting. It's an interesting debate. Like, what is better? What's the superior format? I tend to prefer the Star Trek
Really? Because you've said before that you really like this short run, 8 to 10 episodes, tell your story, be done.
I do, but it's so prevalent now that it's becoming a bit old hat. Every show is like that.
I don't think every one show is superior wants to, every, over the other. I think okay, they're just yeah. different.
And I think then, you're like, right. They're
hopefully
different.
You can use each of them for their advantages.
My only... I just feel like the Star Trek method is just going away, though. There's less of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the CW still does the Star Trek format. It's like 20-episode seasons, and they're for Supergirl, for instance. Mm-hmm. That is the Star Trek format. It does have, like, a grand story in the background, but generally, it's just like, now I'm fighting the Martian Manhunter.
Yeah.
Now, like, my mother's cousin has come down to Earth from Krypton, and I have to fight her.
Isn't Modern Family that format, too? Doesn't it have, like, a million seasons with a million episodes?
It does it? Okay.
I haven't watched it much, but...
Yeah, what about The Office? How many episodes typically per season The Office?
I want to say like 20-something.
I also want to say 20, but it might be a bit 22? Less.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know either. I mean, but then like those comedies that came after The Office in more modern times, like The Good Place, which essentially is the same, similar format,
mm-hmm.
like 10, 13 episodes. So they've, for even comedy, like modern hip comedies, they've decreased the amount of episodes.
Hmm.
X-Men Evolution, on the other hand, bucking all trends, it's 17 episodes in season 2, which is kind right. of a weird number. Somewhere in between.
Uh-huh.
This is the conclusion of season 2.
I thought we got a lot of payoff in this episode.
Yes, a lot, and it really like slapped us in the face with a lot of our criticisms. Finally, I mean,
yeah.
Finally, they had to. It just seems like they had to do it, though.
Yeah,
they had to give answers to these questions we kept hectoring the show about.
Right.
It's interesting too. A lot of people in our Facebook group and on Twitter reached out to me saying, like, keep sticking with it. Like, we get your criticisms, they're valid.
Uh-huh.
But if you stick with it, trust me, it's going to pay off. Don't spoil yourself.
Yeah.
So they're right. This was a cool episode. It's hopefully the start of a new chapter in the show's history going forward for seasons 3 and 4.
Yeah.
And I liked sort of everything that happened. So, Sonia, why don't you take us down the road here with how it begins?
Okay, well, we start where we left off from the part one episode with a sentinel that's got Wolverine in its clutches and it's about to terminate him. But right at that moment, the sentinel gets shut down and we find out that it's Trask just running experiments. So he basically is like, all right, repair the sentinel, reboot it, whatever. Let's get Wolverine into like a healing chamber and then we'll run it again later or yeah. something.
I mean, I had problems in the previous episode thinking that Wolverine, he could have easily smashed the Sentinel. And
this is like a modern high powered Sentinel.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this episode kind of like differentiated things for me.
Yeah.
Like Wolverine, it became more plausible that he could have been defeated by the Sentinel. Cause like you said, it's way more stronger and high powered than the tin cans we saw in the previous series. And the healing factor with Wolverine is just a little bit different in the show,
mm-hmm.
where I guess it is believable. I mean, you know, in the original animated series 2, Wolverine, he didn't heal instantly like he does in the movies, where you blow off his face and his face heals in 4 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
He'd always have to go into convalescence.
Yeah.
You couldn't kill him, but he'd have to wear bandages around his chest and be in a coma for a while at times. So this is more of that healing factor Wolverine.
I kind of like that better. I feel like that's... you know, a little closer to human, makes him a little bit more vulnerable because at least he's like taken out of the action for a little while he has to heal up.
I think Wolverine in the comics started off that way too. His healing factor wasn't quite so insanely accelerated, and I think the movies did a lot for defining the modern idea of what his healing factor should be,
mm-hmm.
and the comic books took note from that, because you start to see a lot more gruesome healings in the comics, mm-hmm. in more modern issues where his skin gets like almost totally eviscerated by fire and he's just a metal skeleton or something,
right?
And it all heals back, or his head gets decapitated and like because it's close enough to his body it reattaches,
mm-hmm.
things where
they're pushing the limits,
right?
Of that power.
It got more gruesome and insane in the comics, and I think that is from the movies. The movies like establish that Wolverine has got magical like instant skin reconstruction.
Well, you get different like storytelling advantages from the two different styles, right?
Right.
Like in the movies, they're very Wolverine centric, so they want to keep him in the action.
Yeah,
so the faster he can heal, the more amazing he is, and also the faster he can be a relevant character in the storyline again. Whereas here, they kind of go the opposite way, which I kind of like.
Yeah.
Why are you laughing?
Because I have an insane tangent about X-Men 2.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, real quick. I was just thinking, given Wolverine's super advanced healing powers in the movies, in X-Men 2, when he gets shot in the head by the police officer and he goes down, I don't even know why he would fall on the ground and be knocked out for a few minutes.
He's not immune to physics.
But he's got an adamantium covered skull.
Yeah.
And you would think that the bullet would just penetrate an inch of his skin and bounce off the skeleton and he would be fine either way. It's not like the bullet can even scratch an adamantium surface.
Yeah, but he has all, like, layers of flesh and stuff, no?
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, how much layer of flesh do you have before you hit the skeleton of your head? I
couldn't tell you.
All right. Anyway, that's why I slapped. It's totally stupid.
Anyway, in this iteration of him in X-Men Evolution, they kind of go the other way. Like, they take him out of commission for the episode because he's convalescing, and I kind of like that, too.
Okay.
You know, because it makes him not completely invulnerable.
You know what? Again, another random tangent. Yeah. This version of Wolverine's healing factor, it's similar to what you get of Captain America in the movies. Because he technically has a healing factor, too. He breaks all his bones all the time.
Yeah.
He's getting horribly beaten up and blown up and all this stuff. And you see him in the hospital a lot. But the thing is, like, he's going to heal perfectly fine. And they don't outright say it, but the implication is he's got an advanced healing factor himself.
Yeah.
That's the Wolverine cartoon healing factor. He needs to go to the hospital and heal up. As opposed to just, you don't see Captain America get blown up in the face and his skin reforming itself in real time.
Right.
Probably takes a day or two. Same with Spider-Man, who theoretically also has an advanced healing factor.
Anyway, should we move along with
the episode? I'm sorry.
Okay, so then meanwhile, all the young mutants are still in the X-Mansion and they realize that they're locked in, they're under attack, they can't get down, can't get out, so they have to go shut down the main computer in the basement, essentially.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Cyclops, Boom Boom, and Magma are outside, like, a waterfall sort of thing.
That's secret entrance where the jet comes out sometimes.
Right, exactly. And they're, like, going through the underground tunnels to also try to reach the mainframe computer, I guess, and shut it down.
Right, so the whole shutdown of the X computer before it blows up the mansion is the weakest part of the episode in the sense that it's edited the most awkwardly. It's like they might have cut out a scene or two, as we'll see later on. I mean, let's just describe the New Mutant story in total right now.
Okay.
So Scott, with the help of Magma and Boom Boom, he breaks into the mansion. He finds out that the mansion's going to explode. The other New Mutants are there. No one knows what to do. It's counting down to 10 seconds.
They're really, like, standing around awkwardly for too long.
Yeah, right. There's 30 seconds to go, and they cannot make up their minds. They do get out in the nick of time through a secret exit.
They go into the Cerebro room.
Right. This is all intercut with the other action going on in the episode. But at a certain point, when there's a point where Scott's breaking into the mansion. He doesn't know yet about the mansion exploding. And the kids certainly don't know about the mansion exploding. But there's this awkward edit where you just cut to Iceman in the X computer room where he sees that there's the countdown. It's blowing up. That was never explained, how those New Mutant kids just stumbled upon that. You wouldn't even think they would have a suspicion that the mansion was going to blow up, at least as far as from what I understood with the episode. So I think that was like the most awkwardly.
Well, no, they weren't down there because they knew that the mansion was going to blow up. It was because all of, like, the security cameras and, like, weapons defense systems inside the mansion were targeting them. And they were like, okay, we have to put a stop to this.
Did they say that? Is that a line in there that I missed?
No, but they showed it that, that camera system was, like, shooting lasers at them. And they kept having to, like, play defense against them. And they were like, okay, let's find the computer and shut it.
But did they say that line? Let's find the computer and shut it down.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, all right. Maybe I missed that. I don't know. To me, it felt like a leap of weird. It's like they cut out a scene where they should have said something like that.
I think there was a scene where Iceman says, like, we have to go find the computer.
Okay, all right, fair enough. But anyway, so for that subplot of the episode, the New Mutants and Cyclops, they're all okay, obviously. But the mansion does explode spectacularly. And that's fully in the tradition of all X-Men content.
Right. There's a lot of rebuilding going on.
Of that one piece of property. all right. What is the sort of main thing going on in this episode?
So at the end of the last episode, we saw the Magneto orbs landing, like, next to the river in New York City somewhere. They open up and all of our, like, bad guy characters emerge from them. And it's, like, pretty cool bad guys. We get Gambit, Colossus, Pyro, Magneto himself and Sabretooth.
Right.
So we're back at this waterfront property, wherever they are, warehouse area or something. And Professor X and Storm are in the X-Men helicopter. Does that have a name? The X...
They did mention it in the previous episode. Yeah, let's just call it the X-Copter.
I forget what they called it. Yeah. Anyway. And they're, like, communicating with the different teams of the Brotherhood of Mutants, and the X-Men are kind of, like, mixed and matched into little groups, and they're sort of patrolling around these warehouses. They're looking for Magneto.
Yeah. So Professor X wanted to unite the teams to confront Magneto. They don't know what Magneto's motivations are. And
it's going pretty well, though. Like, the we get, like, a bunch of encounters between, like, the bad guys and our now, like, unified good guy
teenager
teams.
Group, yeah.
You know, and, like, they do actually work well together, and it kind of makes sense. They all go to high school together. They know each other. Like, it's, you know, it's kind of cool, these little, like, vignettes of fighting that we get.
Does Gambit say one line in this episode?
No.
I was waiting for him. Yeah, I was waiting for him to speak.
Well, he has a little encounter with Rogue.
Yeah.
Where he, like, they just kind of walk up to each other and they have, like, a look of love in their eyes. And then Gambit hands Rogue, like, a flaming card.
Was not in love with the flaming card effect in the series. I mean, again, this is my bias for the original one, where I just totally prefer that version of Gambit top to bottom and the way those effects of his cards look.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't that bad.
The first scene where you see the cards, it's slow, which isn't what we're used to. It really, like, wafts down like a tissue in the breeze.
He does,
except flaming.
He flicks a few of them in a weird way where he, like, lightly, gently pushes them with his finger and they go fast, which speaks to the weird way the cards are charged up by energy.
Uh-huh.
So, you're right. It's a kind of, like, a different presentation of the power.
It's really, like, flames. I feel like in the original series, it was more like lasers.
Right, it was more like some, like, energy, like, he charges it up with this glowing, like, iridescent energy.
Yeah.
And I kind of just prefer the Gambit that really has to throw hard, like, he's almost like throwing a sidearm. I guess he's like throwing a frisbee, more, but really hard. He throws a frisbee in the original series, or he holds the cards as a deck in his hand and flips them out,
which
is his, like, best move. This Gambit, like you said, is a little more playful, a little more just like, let me just slide the cards like a blackjack dealer,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of like the Gambit you saw in the Wolverine Origins movie, too.
I don't know. I don't mind that they gave his power
a little bit of a different style. Yeah.
And it fits with the style of the show, I think.
Yeah.
I like that they kept, like, that black... what do you call it? It's not a mask because it doesn't really cover his face, but it covers, like, the sides of his head.
His yoga hoodie. He's, like, wearing a onesie. It's like wearing yoga pants and a yoga shirt.
I don't know either.
I'll describe it.
And I like the encounter with Rogue. We were kind of waiting for that. I wish they had a little bit of dialogue, but they're kind of, like, intrigued with each other.
To me, the implication was he hypnotized her, which is one of Gambit's...
Lesser-known powers
that his eyeballs can, I forget from my Marvel trading cards. Like, he could either charm people or hypnotize them into loving him or just doing whatever he says. Something about his eyeballs that are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the implication I got, like, why Rogue was so dumbfounded to see him.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise it really wouldn't have made sense. I don't think she would have been... It's not like the implication was she was head over heels so attracted to this man that she had to just hold his flaming card of death for a minute before she realized what was happening.
Yeah, she, like, snaps out of it and she throws it. And
yeah.
It's fine.
Right.
But... anyway, a little encounter with them. There's also another little encounter where Kitty, phases Colossus through a wall so that he's inside a building. And then she, like, phases back out and tells Avalanche, like, okay.
Knock the building down.
Yeah.
But as she's phasing him, there's a weird sort of intimate...
moment between them.
Kind of. But it was enough there that you would get it.
I mean, in both of those cases, maybe, like, we're looking hard for it. So.
I think it was intentional.
Yeah.
I think it was intentional they had Kitty go after Colossus, and she sort of has him up in his arms almost like they're going to kiss before she pulls him into the building. I didn't like Colossus's look. Looked too much like a robot man to me versus organic
metal
skin.
Man.
But I think, again, that's more to the animation style of the overall presentation of how they draw characters.
Mm-hmm. Anything else stick out about those fights to you?
Pyro is not so interesting. Beast versus Sabretooth. I did like the one moment where Beast uses his feet to defeat Sabretooth briefly.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's, like, such a big deal. Revisiting the early Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, X-Men, just his feet was so much a part of his power.
Mm.
That he's so... like, he can balance himself on one toe that his feet can, like, grip into brick buildings. That's how he climbs walls, like Spider-Man.
Right.
That it's just, like, the whole thing with his feet being, like, extra large and weird. So him seeing him use his feet, like, specifically was like, oh, yeah, that's Beast.
Yeah.
So I did like that moment. There's a moment where Rogue absorbs Beast's power when he's knocked out.
Mm.
And she just has super strength for a minute to kick Sabretooth.
That seems like it would be so useful for her. Because otherwise she's kind of just, like, flipping and stuff.
Yeah. I know,
as we've said before, you know? Like, she doesn't have, like, everyday powers that she can just use all the time.
But here's my question. Like, you absorb the powers of Beast.
Then Beast has less power?
Well, not even that. I mean, he's already unconscious, so I'm sure that's probably not safe for him to... But my thing is, like, shouldn't Rogue...
Should she be blue?
I would say she doesn't necessarily have to be blue,
uh-huh.
But you would think that her feet would have to grow out of her shoes. I'm serious. Like, that's like uh-huh. That's what it's mean power is, like, oversized hands and feet,
uh-huh.
And the super agility and obviously super strength. But uh-huh. It was just kind of like a like, to me, it just left the question of, like, how would the comics show Rogue absorbing Beast's power? Because I don't think the cartoon, like, really cared to think about it too much. They just quickly did it and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that's an interesting question. Certain characters, like, absorbing Beast's character, like, what does that actually mean for Rogue? How does she get mutated by him?
Yeah, here it was a little bit more of just, like, a throwaway.
Yeah,
quick.
Definitely.
So, anyway, basically there's, like, this massive fight going on.
Magneto is on a skyscraper away from this industrial zone where they're fighting. Quicksilver is inexplicably by his side.
I guess he turned coat.
Right. He promised Mystique in the previous episode that he was on her side.
But no.
No, he's on Magneto's side.
Wanda catches sight of him and starts, like, walking towards the building.
Marching slowly towards the building.
And then Storm and the rest of the X-Men and Brotherhood also, like, realize what's going on and they follow Wanda.
But this is all happening above the Secret Sentinel factory, and this is Magneto's plan. He wants to draw out Trask's Sentinels to reveal mutants to the world.
There's only one Sentinel
right now. Right, yeah, only one Sentinel. And so, actually, I thought this was a good master plan by Magneto, mainly because it's like, thank you, Magneto, for fixing the overall plot of the show.
Yeah.
It's just, like, letting the world know about mutants so we could, like, actually understand the X-Men's place in the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, his plan is to make mutants known finally so that he could see them fighting for their lives against, like, a monstrous Gungam-style Sentinel monster. And, right, but so Trask sees all this with his security cameras underground, and he decides to unleash the Sentinel on the mutants, and that's where the next phase of the fighting comes in.
Right, well, Magneto, like, essentially creates an enormous sinkhole under a bunch of the mutants, so they, like, fall into the earth, and then with that hole there, Magneto, like, raises the Sentinel up onto the ground level where it starts going after the rest of the mutants.
Yeah.
And, of course, they have to fight him. Like, it's Jean and Storm and, like, a bunch of them.
And in my brain, I'm like, this should be an easy fight, but it's
right,
a different...
it's only one Sentinel.
Right, but it's a different kind of Sentinel. It's just sort of, like, way more ultra-armored and
it's more advanced.
Overpowered than what we saw in the original series. So I was like, Storm, just electrocute it.
Yeah.
So, and Storm almost does take it out a few times. She starts a tornado at one point that almost knocks it over. Does the Sentinel actually blow up at the end?
Yeah.
They get it? Yeah, at some point. Oh, who gets it?
Magneto actually gets it.
It shoots rockets at Magneto, and he just barely turns the rockets back at the Sentinel and blows it up.
Right, and his plan totally works. There's helicopters, you know, like news helicopters that are supposed to be covering the traffic or whatever, end up turning their cameras over towards the fighting that's going on. And it's... I thought this part was, like, pretty well done.
I thought it was really cool. Yeah.
That they portray.
They capture them in a third-person news broadcast of them fighting. There were some good angles of it. It introduced some realism into the...
And the dialogue also of the newscasters.
Yes,
like,
speculating
about what's actually going on.
Are they aliens?
Right. Did they mutate?
Right.
What is this giant metal robot?
Yeah, what's going... Like, who could we trust here? The robot or these weird people with their powers?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, like, they did a long way to fixing the main show's premise problem.
And also, it shows a little bit of, like, the fallout, right? Because, like, now a bunch of the news stations have their cameras turned on to the Sentinel mutant fight, and then they cut to, like, all of the X-Men's high school friends watching from home on TV, just being, like, totally shocked. Like
Karen.
Duncan, Jean's boyfriend.
Yeah, Scott's sort of girlfriend.
Yeah.
Nightcrawler's girlfriend, who knew about his powers, weirdly.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the reaction from her isn't of shock. Like, she knows about mutants. Her reaction is a little bit more like, oh no. Like, oh, she understands the implications for Kurt and his friends.
Right. There's some good stuff from Magneto and stuff. Wanda, you know, she's going to get her revenge on Magneto. So she almost gets him killed because she blocks Magneto's power while the Sentinel's attacking him. Luckily, at the last second, like, you know, Magneto manages to break free and stop the Sentinel.
It's because she turns her attention towards, like, I guess...
Oh, Professor X is shooting the Sentinel from his helicopter.
I think it's the army guys, isn't it?
No. It's Professor X. No, well, they're Magneto's holding them back. He's holding back the army from engaging. Yeah. But Professor X tries to save Magneto. He shows up with his helicopter and shooting the Sentinel, and Wanda turns his attention to him. She says, leave me alone.
Right. Stay out of this. This isn't your fight, basically. Right.
And
because her attention is turned there, she's not withholding Magneto's powers
anymore. But who is really this person?
Right. So when all is said and done, Professor X, like, the Sentinel blows up, like, the newscasters are descending on them, and Professor X is like, all right, mutants, let's go. He, like, gathers them all into the helicopter, and they fly back to the mansion. They see that it's exploded. They land. Luckily, you know, Scott and the New Mutants come out of the bushes being like, we're fine, don't worry. Professor X is in his chair looking on, being like, oh boy. And Jean tries to go hug Scott and be like, oh my god, you're all right. And his shirt is like half torn off.
He's not too interested in the hug, which I was surprised. I thought for sure they were going to kiss, like they were going to get the resolution to
He's not interested because he has another priority right now. Right. He like shakes her off and goes over to Professor X and like shockingly like pulls Professor X up by the collar and is like, you have some explaining to do.
This is quite the Big Lebowski moment. Seriously. Where John Goodman goes to the Big Lebowski and shakes him out of the wheelchair. This guy fucking walks. I've seen Cripple Jobs and Nom, and this guy's a faker. I could tell him out. And Lebowski, Jeff Lebowski's like, come on, dude. I don't think so. Don't do it. And then just drops him on the floor. No, but in this case, Cyclops.
In this case, yeah, Scott was right. It's not actually Professor X. It's Mystique, and she transforms and reveals herself.
So when did this happen?
She promises, she's like, and things are going to be getting much worse.
Right, and they're standing under the flaming wreckage of the mansion, and the season's over.
Right.
All
right,
so
there, where did the switcheroo happen?
Yes, that's a big question. We got to find out. Uh-huh. I can't speculate. I mean, I would say the whole season, because Professor X is... We've talked about how bananas he is.
Yeah.
But it doesn't quite add up, because there's definitely multiple scenes where there's Risty as Mystique undercover at the X-Mansion.
It could just be from, like, the beginning of part one of this two-parter. That's more likely,
yeah.
Because, like, I think also it's a little out of character with Professor X to have, like... left Scott behind when all the other characters are like, what about Scott?
Yeah, that's like, not a big deal. Yeah, and also the fact that... the merging of the two teams in the first place seems a bit odd.
Yeah.
And you could also maybe even point to the previous Wanda episode too, where there might have been some weirdness going on with the character. But yeah, like, excellent ending to season two.
Yeah, they really ramped it up. And in a way, now, in hindsight, I'm kind of glad that they did all that weird stuff where nobody knew about mutants because the payoff was so good. And now there's, like, a clear delineation of, like, the before times, like, before people knew. Then, like, what the fallout is going to be in society in, like, the seasons going forward now that people know about mutants. Are they going to do, like, a whole storyline about, like... everyone's cheering for the mutants because they defeated the Sentinel, but then they like end up turning on them because they realize how powerful they are. You know, they can go a lot of directions with this.
I'm kind of on the fence. Part of me feels like they're just fixing the show. Mm-hmm. A bit like...
you don't think this was planned out from the beginning?
Batman versus Superman, when like they tried to say like, oh, Batman was annoyed that Superman killed a million people in Metropolis, where the last movie didn't establish that as a problem at all. It's just kind of like a response to the fan criticism. It's not to that deep level with this show, probably, but I am at the very least happy that it's like orienting the world of the X-Men more properly at its foundation, which is, again, our biggest sort of criticism of the show up to this point, that it was just, why are they just all secretive and what's going on here?
Yeah.
But hey, it is the younger X-Men and it's a different story. So they're launching that part of the story in their own way, and I am very curious about seasons 3 and 4. Do you have any final thoughts here before we conclude officially season 2, another season of an X-Men animated series in the books?
No, I think I kind of said I liked the wrap up, and it did make me look forward to what's going to come next in this series.
And look forward to it we shall, so keep sticking with us. We'll be back with season 3 next week. And more WandaVision, too.
Yeah.
All right, good night, everybody.
Good night.